The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Theresa May heads to Brussels to seal phase one of the Brexit deal as the government suffers a defeat in the Commons. But will the hard-won, meaningful vote in Parliament really be all that meaningful? We'll get the latest from Westminster.
I'm disappointed with the amendment, but actually the EU withdrawal bill is making good progress through the House of Commons, and we're on course to deliver on Brexit.
Plus, we have a panel packed with authors, so we'll pick out the best books to give the political obsessives in your life. But first, having last week snatched a Brexit deal victory from the jaws of defeat, this week it was back to plain old defeat for Theresa May. 11 Tory rebels defeated the government on an amendment forcing them to put the final Brexit deal to a meaningful vote before Britain leaves the EU. We're joined on the line now by a political reporter, Jessica Elgott. Jess, take us through the drama. There was a long debate yesterday, wasn't there? And a lot of kind of quite powerful speeches, and it became clearer and clearer as the day went on that this was going to be a very, very tight vote.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was a lot of kind of last minute drama as well around it. So you had certain Tory MPs making sort of quite emotional speeches, including George Freeman, who was once a sort of very influential policymaker in Number 10. He made a big speech about how he was going to vote with the rebels, and then at the end, after a last-minute concession by Dominic Raab, said, "Oh, actually, I won't." So there were so many people were so clearly right on the line right until the very last moment. Vicky Ford, another one of the rebels who was supposed to vote for the amendment, you know, sort of started. You could see her in the chamber kind of wavering between the two lobbies, and the Chancellor kind of took her gently by the arm and led her into the no lobby. There was a lot of you know, the kind of drama you don't normally see on the floor of the House of Commons last night.
And meanwhile, behind the scenes, we're told, and one of the reasons it passed is because Labour Brexiters, who have sometimes voted with the government, were persuaded to swing behind this amendment, weren't they? We're told Jeremy Corbyn had a hand in that, but it was on both sides of the House that the whipping was going on, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Labour whips want you to know that they definitely played their part in this as well. I think that one of the things that was really sort of through the government was that they normally can count on 7, maybe 8 Labour Brexiteers to vote with them on matters that are about Brexit. This time there were only 2, Frank Field and Kate Hoey. All throughout the day, the Labour whips were working on some of the Brexiteers in their party to try and get them to vote, you know, to show them that there was a chance actually to defeat the government on this. Jeremy Corbyn, we understand, rang some of them, but I'm told that a key person was Dennis Skinner, who was convinced quite early on, and then brought some of the other Brexiters on board himself. He was kind of acting, you know, as a bit of a conduit for the Whip's office. So that's a quite unusual scenes again, but all really crucial when the vote's that tight.
And Julian Smith, Theresa May's new chief whip, who replaced Gavin Williamson when he was promoted to Defence Secretary, he's not had a good press this morning, has he?
He hasn't. It seems like a lot of the Tory MPs who were displeased about yesterday's result are blaming him, saying, you know, that you know, his tactics obviously didn't work very well. It hasn't been a good week or, you know, fortnight for Julian Smith. He was also got a bit of the flak for the collapse of the last week at the beginning of last week of the EU negotiations, when he was, you know, sort of tacitly blamed for not bringing the DUP on board. And this time, you know, it was clear throughout the whole of the day yesterday that the relationship was really deteriorating between the whips and the rebels. There was, you know, accusations flying about that someone had made one of the female MPs cry. It came out that one of the whips had said, if you know sort of tell the press about us, then they will sue you. I mean, that's quite an extraordinary thing to happen between whips and MPs who are supposed to be on the same side. So it really was, by the end of the day, a really bad-tempered relationship.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that these MPs, the group we're talking about, so Dominic Grieve, Nicky Morgan, Anna Soubry, you know, a lot of them are sort of former lawyers. They're not natural rebels, are they, really? I mean, they got dubbed mutineers by the Telegraph, you know, a few weeks ago, and the Daily Mail did a sort of very you know, rude front page about them this morning. But they're not sort of serial rebels, are they? Dominic Grieve made that point very clearly.
No, not at all. And Stephen Hammond was saying it again this morning. He was vice chair of the Tory party, says he's never rebelled once in 12 years. And he also made the point there are people in the cabinet who, as he said, tried to bring down the Cameron government. So he's making the point very clear that he didn't want to rebel again, but also hinting that he might. And, you know, one of the whips that I saw yesterday after the vote candidates said that they thought this was a really significant moment, not just because of what it meant for Brexit or for the process of leaving the EU in Parliament, because the dam had broken, and that once rebels sort of get a taste for that they can change things in a very finely balanced hung parliament, then they start to think, well, what else can we change? And thought it was a very significant moment for the parliament.
And there is another key vote coming up next week, isn't there? Because the government tabled this amendment itself to its own piece of legislation, which will put the date at which we leave the EU into law. And that's something quite a few Tory MPs find problematic, isn't it? Could there be another rebellion next week, you think?
I think it's very possible there could be. Dominic Grieve said it on Newsnight last night that, you know, he wasn't prepared to back down over that. Stephen Hammond as well said he thought that it was a big mistake to enshrine the date in law. And I think, you know, that those concerns are shared by the people who rebelled last night. It's even possible that it could be a larger rebellion. The government was really, in Downing Street this morning, said that they were holding firm on it, that they absolutely were not going to withdraw that amendment. But there's a week to go, and we'll see how negotiations go in that time.
And you talked about the impact on Brexit. We shouldn't get too overexcited, should we? This is Parliament flexing its muscles. It might change the tone of the debate, but this is not going to stop Brexit, is it?
No, I don't think it is going to stop Brexit, but it might make a soft Brexit more likely. Well, at least that's what I think some of the rebels think, that the way that they sort of see the timeline going is that if you get a deal in October, that gives you 6 months before the end of the Article 50 process to kind of have a look at that deal and you know, potentially try and soften it. But I don't know if that's something that the EU would agree to. That would mean going back to the negotiating table again. It's very complex, and the timing is very difficult. So perhaps what they hope for might actually not end up being the case.
But at the very least, when the cabinet discussed the end state, as it's called, the kind of future deal they want with the EU next Tuesday at this crucial cabinet meeting, at the very least they'll have in the back of their minds the fact that there's a few rebels out there in the parliamentary party willing to back a somewhat softer Brexit. Jessica Elgott in Westminster there, thanks very much. Well, I'm joined now by Labour MP Jess Phillips, author of Every Woman, One Woman's Truth About Speaking the Truth. On the line in Brussels, we have Tom McTague of Politico, co-author of Betting the House, the inside story of the 2017 election. And down the line, we have Gabby Hinsliff, who's been reading piles of political books to review them for the end of the year. So, Tom, we've talked a bit already about Theresa May's defeat in Westminster last night. You're there in Brussels waiting for her to arrive. What faces her when she gets there?
Well, I think confusion a lot in Brussels. You know, a lot of my colleagues here just often ask me, what is going on in British politics?
Good question.
And it's always hard to explain. And there is always slight, you know, confusion about, you know, misunderstandings about what things mean. But things just suddenly blow up and really make waves here, such as David Davis's interview. Now, that's still being talked about today.
He said the agreement struck last week was a statement of intent rather than anything more binding.
That's it. And the commissioner, actually, the day or two after, said that was, you know, legally correct. But I think it's about trust. Somebody was saying to me this morning that there's this lack of trust from this side here in Brussels about the UK government and what they can do. And is Theresa May actually speaking on behalf of Parliament? You know, does she have the authority to get whatever deal she gets here back through Parliament when she returns?
So that's the impact of a vote like last night's, is it? It's chipping away at the sense that she's got the authority to do the deal.
Absolutely. And I think that was most obviously shown when she turned up on the Monday last week and thought she had a deal and then got a phone call from Arlene Foster and had to go home quickly with her tail between her legs. You know, that is over here. That's just a sort of bizarre behaviour, and they don't understand it. You know,
it's quite bizarre from over here, to be honest. But
well, I mean, I think one of the things they say about they sort of pride themselves in Brussels on being reliable. Somebody said, you know, we are the sort of the last reliable partner in the Western world. You know, that's their view of themselves, and they see the Anglo-Saxon world, as they say it, sort of crumbling in reliability and being all erratic. Now, I mean, I think that's a view. I mean, it's you know, I think you can easily argue against that, but that's how they see it at the moment. They're just not sure the person they're dealing with is going to be around for that long, or whether she has the authority to do what's necessary.
And Jess, you were there last night walking through the division lobbies with those rebel Tories, those mutineers. What was the atmosphere like?
Oh, it was phenomenal, actually, which is saying something, because walking around in circles for no end can be quite a depressing way to make a living.
Which is how MPs vote, we should say.
Yeah, sorry, we walk around in circles. So it was amazing. And as I went in through one of the doorways into the lobby where you're looking down on everyone who is in the lobby and trying to work out whether the right amount of people were in there.
It was really tight, wasn't it?
It was really, really exciting. And I could see Antoinette Sandbach, because she's really tall, and Heidi Allen I could see, but I couldn't see that many more. And as I was walking in, Nicky Morgan was sat in the chamber, and she had three whips in front of her, desperately trying to get her to go the other way. And it's just like this vision of this woman just sat there with three people on, like, sort of really, really pressuring her, was something I've not seen before in the House of Commons.
Yeah, extraordinary. Gabby, we shouldn't get too carried away, though, should we? This was Parliament asserting itself, but it's not going to kind of stop this process.
No, it's not the end of Brexit as we know it. And perhaps some of those leavers who are getting wildly excited and denouncing their colleagues as traitors should perhaps remember that. You know, it is restoring sovereignty to Parliament, which is what supposedly this process was all about. It gives Parliament a meaningful vote on whatever's produced, but it doesn't necessarily mean that means, you know, Parliament's going to take that opportunity to throw it out. You know, the referendum verdict still stands. MPs will still be very aware of what their constituents voted for and what they wanted. But it is, I think, Parliament sort of in some ways shaking itself out of paralysis that it got into, you know, a feeling that it didn't have a role in this process and that the will of the people was paramount. Actually, there is a lot of questions about how exactly the will of people should be expressed. You know, what sort of Brexit, how, when, in what form, what does that mean for all the things that weren't on the ballot paper? And it's perfectly proper for Parliament to have a role in deciding how Brexit works and whether it works as smoothly as possible.
And Tom, it's also about the power balance between the kind of warring forces within Theresa May's cabinet too, isn't it? And the way that argument plays out, this flexing of muscles by MPs, does it make a difference to those conversations?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, we had a couple of days before this vision of Parliament welcoming Theresa May back from Brussels as sort of a conquering hero. And it was remarkable to watch down from the press gallery and to see Ken Clark and Ian Duncan Smith hailing her triumph. And then actually, you know, at that point, I think I wrote a piece saying that the Tory party was broadly united behind the Prime Minister. And then
it's been a long week.
24 hours later, you have this vote. And actually, it's the Remainers that are the main problem for her. And they're not large in number, but their influence is huge because of the balance of power in the in Parliament. And I think it's just a reminder to the Prime Minister that she is running a minority government, and Parliament therefore is just more powerful, and that sort of reality has to be accepted over the next year.
Right. Now, with 10 shopping days left till Christmas, there's still plenty of time to panic buy some of the best books of the year, and not just from tax avoiding online retailers. And some of the best of them have been written by members of our panel. Jess, tell us a bit about Every Woman. Why did you write it?
The truth is, Heather, it's because somebody asked me to. It's like a brilliant opportunity, I think, when somebody asks you to write down what you've been saying, you know, to your mates or down the pub for all those years, all those opinions that you'd had. But I suppose the main reason I sort of decided to do it is because I see at the moment in politics a sort of a real wave of progress around women in politics, whether that's from sort of Angela Merkel, Theresa May, although she's having a rocky time. We are seeing the rise of women making it to the top of politics. But at the same time, the backlash against women with voices has never been stronger. So for every step forward, it seems there is a pushback. And I wanted to talk about some of what that push and pull feels like, and try, I suppose, encourage other women to speak up. People often say to me, oh, you're very brave, I wish I could say the things that you say. And I want people to realise that actually the more of us that say the things that I say, or even just say our opinions as women, the more likely it is people will just get over it and stop moaning.
And Gabby, as Jess says, that far more women in politics than there were. But towards the end of the year, we've had this sort of post-Weinstein sort of, you know, series of cases and a whole conversation about whether politics is a great place to be a woman. Do you worry that you know, people get frightened out of becoming involved because of those kinds of things?
I think there's a really hard balance, isn't there, between wanting to tell the truth about what it's like. And you noticed earlier this week when we had the report into intimidation during the election campaign, and a couple of MPs saying, I wouldn't have stood if I had known what it was going to be like, what kind of abuse I was going to be subjected to. You know, you don't want to put people off entering public life by sort of telling the unvarnished truth. But at the same time, you know, if we don't talk about it, if we don't discuss the fact that that's what it's like, it's never going to change. It's a bit like when you're pregnant and no one ever tells you what childbirth is like, because you know, you have to go through with it by then. It's better that you don't know in advance. It's a bit like that. There's a sort of balance between being honestly preparing you for something and not terrifying the life out of people. I have to say, coming back to the political books, I did review a ton of them this year. And while last year I did the Christmas books roundup again last year for The Guardian, and was really struggling to find books written by women. There didn't seem to be any political books written by women. This year there was a really strong crop of them, which means that publishing houses think that women want to read about politics and think of women when they're commissioning books about politics. And that struck me as a real sea change and a positive thing.
Oh, that's made me feel much better.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're a really strong advocate for you know, the advantages that being an MP gives you, right, Jess, and the platform it gives you and all those things. You know, you also talk about the abuse that you face and people trying to silence you. But you know, you would encourage women absolutely to go to do this.
Absolutely, because, you know, I have a massive platform now, and I'm not just saying those things down the pub. People are listening to them. I get to tell the Prime Minister what I think of how she's conducting herself, and I get to say, especially in a post-Weinstein era, I get to be somebody who is listening to the voices of those women and is trying to change it. And that is such a privilege. It is a delicious privilege, and it far outweighs any abuse that I could get at all. And to be perfectly honest, I definitely get more fan mail than I get hate mail. And the hate mail tends to amuse me quite a lot.
Tom, as the token male on the panel, you're a close observer of all this. Do you feel, notwithstanding the sexual harassment type allegations, that you know, there are more women involved in the conversations and willing to speak out, and that it sort of changes the tone of the debate, slightly more women in the front line?
Absolutely. I mean, when we were writing the book, you know, we had to. You know, Tim Ross and I, obviously two men writing a book, and the characters are, there's, you know, prominent characters in the story are women. And, you know, I was just thinking about it now, the chiefs of staff, Theresa May's chiefs of staff, Fiona Hill and Nick Timothy, one woman, one man. And the vitriol actually for Fiona was far greater than for Nick. And, you know, I don't know whether that's connected to the fact that she's a woman. And so it's, as Jess says, you know, people are pushing back against her more than against Nick. And also, we ought to have to be careful about how you describe what the two characters bring or brought to Theresa May. You know, often, we found that Nick was described as the brains, but Fiona would advise the Prime Minister on what clothes to wear, you know, such as trousers or, you know, whatever that might be. And, you know, I think it is important to check yourself and to make sure, you know, who's telling you this and what and why. I think people are thinking a lot more about how they write about women in politics.
I heard much more criticism of Fiona, funnily enough, actually, from other MPs, Tory MPs. I remember lots of people saying, oh, she's the kind of woman who'd cross the road to have a fight with you. And that made me just like her. not that I've ever had much dealing with her, but Nick Timothy is entirely the person I blame, as being from this, you know, the same bit of Birmingham as he comes from. He should definitely know how people felt, and they clearly missed the mark.
I think there's a thing when women are aggressive and combative. I mean, lots of people in politics, to be honest, are aggressive and combative. You know, it is not unknown, shall we say, for people working for Number 10 to take no prisoners. There is a lot of shouting that goes on, but somehow when women do it, it's treated as It's weird, you know. It's treated as unusual, somewhat freaky. You know, why is a woman behaving in a way that we've been perfectly comfortable with men behaving for a long time?
And a bit
aggression from women is taken as unseemly in a way.
And a bit ambition as well. I saw somebody when Emily Thornberry was standing in for Jeremy Corbyn at Prime Minister's Questions last week. There were, you know, people saying, "Oh, she's made it a bit too obvious that she wants the leadership." You know, and I thought, well, because you never see a bloke.
If you do a good job at standing in at PMQs, you don't think to yourself, "Well, I might have it." There's something wrong with you as a politician.
Yeah, except I wouldn't encourage Damien Green to feel that way.
Another subject entirely.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and one the lawyers would probably advise us to steer clear of.
I just don't think he was very good at PMQs, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, fair enough. Tom, you spent a long time, I think, in particular looking at Labour's campaign when you were writing about the general election. It seems such a long time ago now, but, and, you know, with hindsight, because the result was so much better than expected, you know, Labour almost got to kind of, the victors almost got to sort of write the story of it, and it all seemed incredibly smooth, and the social media operation was incredibly impressive and so on. But there were sort of tensions and fractures and drama behind the scenes, weren't there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when Tim and I started to write the book, one of the things we were very keen to avoid was to write a book that said, you know, why the Tories lost. You know, it was two stories. And one was, you know, what happened on the Tory side, but also what on earth happened on the Labour side? How did they go from 27% in some of the good polls at the start of the campaign to 40% later on? I mean, I should say behind the scenes, the sort of the fractious relationships. Again, you have this strong female character of Carrie Murphy, who comes in for most of the criticism that we would hear from some of her colleagues and others, you know, who would, you know, be held up as a sort of aggressive woman who holds the leader's office together. But yeah, there was tensions throughout, and I think there was tensions between the leader's office principally and Labour HQ, and those continue to this day. Also between the deputy leader's office and the leader's office, about what is the strategy? You know, and you speak to those who were working on the campaign, and they are absolutely insistent that those early polls were not fake; they were real at the time. The Labour Party was staring down the barrel of a really big defeat. And a combination of events and bravery by Jeremy Corbyn and also the performance of the Prime Minister all contributed to, you know, this remarkable surge that did change in the last 3 weeks.
And interestingly, in a funny sort of way, you know, one of the things that Fiona Hill and Nick Timothy were very good at doing in Number 10 was kind of keeping the criticism and the alternative points of view out of the room, weren't they, and away from Theresa May, whereas, you know, it was all fought out, you know, in Labour.
Like
Labour had the rows in a way that you sort of felt the Tories kind of didn't, and maybe that was a good thing.
Yeah, there was one moment that I thought was quite a nice moment showing Jeremy Corbyn's character, actually, when they're debating internally whether Jeremy should go and to the debate where Theresa May wouldn't show up and she'd sent Amber Rudd in her place, and this is in Cambridge. And there's inside the leader's office, they're split. You know, half of them think, oh, this is a terrible idea. Jeremy would just get picked on. You know, what have we got to win here? But on the other side, they said, no, we can't win at 35%. We need to get higher. You have to take risks. And Jeremy was caught in the middle, and he texts Andrew Gwynn to say, as a friend, what's your advice? And Gwynn says, you know, you've got to do it. Go for it. And he does the next day. And actually, he then goes to Cambridge, and they book out a hotel. They say that the most boring hotel that they could find near Cambridge, so that they could prepare Jeremy without the sort of adulation of his fans sort of coming in and interrupting them. And then it was for that debate that some of Jeremy's team say that they first realised that something had changed on the ground as they were driving into Cambridge. People realised who it was and started to cheer. And that was right towards the end. And I think that was quite a pivotal moment in the campaign. But it wasn't a clear decision. It wasn't an easy decision to make.
Jess, you must have felt it on the ground as it went through, presumably. Not known for being Jeremy's greatest fan, but clearly something went right.
Funnily enough, I had, on that exact same day that has just been described, I had a text conversation with Jeremy Corbyn about exactly the same thing.
And what did you advise him to do?
I encouraged him to do it. But I encouraged him not to fall into the trap that Ed Miliband had fallen into of not ruling out coalitions in the debates in 2015. And Jeremy got back to me almost immediately with sort of a lengthy sort of decision about why they'd decided to do it and that he was certain that we weren't going to fall into that trap, and thanked me for getting in touch with him. But I think that the way it has been described is exactly right, because I spoke to 21,000 people, me and my team spoke to 21,000 people in the 6-week campaign. Now, you can only really go back to your previous Labour promise when you've only got 6 weeks. So you can't.
So that's kind of existing Labour voters, yeah, as well, previous Labour voters.
Yeah, who've said to you in the past that they have voted Labour. We couldn't have in 6 weeks done a campaign where we knocked every single door. It's just not the time. From our previous Labour promise, we had a 36% going away rate, that they were not going to vote Labour in the first 3 weeks. And I was terrified by that. Now, in my region, in the West Midlands, I was one of the ones who would still scrape through with that sort of polling. But many of my colleagues around me would have fallen, people who'd had safe Labour seats in the past. And then I remember having a conversation with Robert Peston. He rang me up and he said, "Is it real? Is the Labour surge real?" This was about 4 weeks in. And I went and checked the data again, and we were then only at an 8% going away rate from the previous week. So something definitely changed midway through the campaign. And I think a lot of that was down to the Labour Party running very, very, very good local campaigns at the same time as Jeremy just being himself. And that's really what people are crying out for, and doing a really, really good job of being everywhere. He was on the telly every time I turned it on, which wasn't very much, been as I had to talk to 21,000 people. And Theresa May being so appalling. The nothing has changed. I sometimes just want to shout that at her in PMQs.
I think you're probably not alone there. And I should say, Tom, that another revelation that stuck in everyone's mind from your book was about the meal that Theresa May held with her key advisers, I think back in February, when they were talking about whether to go for the election.
Well, the chicken lasagna and boiled potatoes.
Chicken lasagna and boiled potatoes. Awful. Just says it all, doesn't it?
Although I do like chicken. I do like lasagna and chips.
Lasagna and chips is a completely different thing.
I think we've put our finger on a cultural divide there.
Lasagna, chips and garlic bread is perfectly acceptable.
Oh, my goodness. Gabby, other political books are available, aren't they? What else have you enjoyed? Give us one or two others.
Of political books are available by people who are not on the panel today. I think the one that is going to get pushed very hard this Christmas is Tim Shipman's All Out War, which covers much the same ground as Tom's book in terms of looking at, you know, why the Tories won, why Labour lost. And I think it's probably, you know, his sort of version of life. He seems to be doing an annual book at the moment on why everything you didn't expect was going to happen just happened. So God knows what 2018 is going to bring. That was probably one of the standouts. And I think a lot of people probably enjoy Robert Peston's WTF. I'm not sure I can say what that stands for.
It's family podcast, Gabby, certainly not.
But, you read the book and find out. And I think also Gordon Brown's biography is obviously out in time for Christmas as well. And I think it's a sort of frustrating book in a lot of ways, because you just keep wanting to sort of put him on the shoulders and shake him. And there's a sort of tremendous lack of self-awareness and a weird lack of other people around him. You know, you can read it without sort of really noticing that anyone else was in government alongside him. It's very much the story of Gordon Brown. You know, like, did you have a cabinet, or were they just not mentioned? But yes, it's a good sort of go back to the starting point of how on earth did we end up where we are now. You know, you really have to go back to that Brown government and to the people, in a sense, that Labour disappointed then, and the seeds of, you know, what we are now seeing being sown, I suppose.
Yeah, it interesting. And we should just look briefly forward as well, I think. Tom, Brexit's going to dominate, isn't it? But thinking about Labour as we just were, Jeremy Corbyn's position, Labour's position, is going to be quite interesting, isn't it, as we go through the Brexit negotiations and as we see some of these tensions between different kinds of future Brexit deal play out?
Absolutely. I mean, going back to the vote last night, you know, to vote for parliamentary sovereignty is a double-edged sword, really, because it's very hard to reclaim that mantle from the Brexiteers, which is a very smart tactic. But in the long run, to then use that mantle to argue for the single market, membership of the single market, which is, as we were all told in the referendum, you know, a fax democracy where you don't get any say over the rules that you have to live by from that point on. I think that's quite a tough sell. And I don't think the Labour Party is united on that at all. You know, I think there are lots of MPs that I speak to who are very concerned about that and the customs union. So there are contradictions on both sides that are going to come to the fore. I don't think that the sort of party's ambiguity can last forever.
Jess, that's right, isn't it? It's very hard. Labour rather cleverly stitched together a kind of electoral coalition that involved, you know, talking slightly one message to Brexiters, voters, and one message to strong Remainers. And that's it's hard to stick with that, isn't it? At some point, there'll be a deal that comes back from Brussels and Labour will have to decide, do we back this or not?
Yeah, no, I think that is right. The Labour Party sort of is taking these tiny little baby steps towards a sort of soft Brexit. And I think, actually, to be perfectly honest, there's a lot of criticism of the Labour Party being unclear about their position. I think they've played an absolute blinder, and I don't know whether it's sort of just accident or that they intended, and they're actually amazing. We are amazing, brilliant strategists. I can't say I'm in on the Brexit negotiation talks much, because the Tories are so monumentally divided on it, and they are still really having to grapple with what is really, to be honest, tedious and intricate, that they fail at Brexit and we can sort of just sit there and be. And that, I think, has to change as if we get a vote on the final offer. And if it is going to cost jobs for people in my constituency, like on a grand scale, then I can't vote for that and I won't vote for that. So it's going to be tricky. I think there is a tricky way ahead. But I do think it is important to point out that nobody in my constituency really ever talks to me about Brexit anymore. So I think this idea that people are wildly passionate one way or the other, actually, in most parts of the country, is a fallacy.
That you said yes, Tom, does that ring true to you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was just laughing about an incident in my own life where we went round for a dinner with some friends and my wife sent a preemptive text or a WhatsApp message saying Brexit talk was banned.
Sensible woman.
And it was just such a lovely night talking about ordinary things like children and, you know,
Strictly Come Dancing.
Strictly Come Dancing, yeah. And that was great. I'd like to impose that rule more often.
The only problem is, though, that people want to shut up. Most people seem to want government to shut up, get on with it, wake us up when it's over, you know, do not bore me with all the details. But then the problem with it, which is quite understandable, I often feel the same myself, and I'm supposed to be writing about it, but it's all very well till you get to the position where government's been left to get on with it and produces a deal that nobody wants, at which point you might be forced to discuss it at the odd dinner party. That's the trouble. What people are interested in isn't necessarily always a very good guide to what is going to affect their lives.
No, and even, heaven forbid, be forced back to the polls to vote on it again, although I personally can't bear the thought. Gabby, can we have a more stable year ahead, do you think?
Please, God, can we have a more stable year ahead? I'm not doing another election. I'm not.
Tom, you can't face another election, presumably, because you'd have to write another book.
There's no way that is going to happen. No, I couldn't do it. I have a one-year-old at home. And I didn't see him for the summer, so that's not happening.
A 24-hour election, maybe. One day of campaigning and that's it. We all go, come on, we've done, we've run through these arguments before, let's just get on with it.
My husband texts me about 3 weeks ago and just said, I want you to know that today is the day that it's legally impossible for there to be an election in 2017. So you can put your feet up now, Bab.
For the time being, at least. All right, on that cheerful note, that's all we have time for this week. There'll be one last Politics Weekly in 2017 with Anoushka next week. But from me, it's Happy Christmas. And my thanks to Gabby Hintzliff, Tom McTague and Jess Phillips. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.